Welcome back to Class Act, Updates in Education Law. I'm Miriam.
I'm not Lisa.
Yes, everybody, this is not Lisa. This is Christina, who is filling in for Lisa today. And we are still attorneys at Walter Haverfield, so that hasn't changed. We do get together every so often. We talk about legal issues, updates, anything relevant to boards of education, administrators, teachers, anybody who works with kids in our schools. Today we have a little bit of a difficult topic, a controversial topic. We will be discussing sex offenders who are parents. And if you typically listen with kids in the car, this
topic isn't for
you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe listen to this podcast when there are no kids in the car, because we will be talking about some upsetting issues and sexual violence will be mentioned in this episode. Before we kind of jump into sex offenders who are parents, I do want to give a little bit of background and history to the laws and regulations. Now,
and maybe before you even do that, maybe we should back up just one step and say that the laws that we're going to be talking about today are federal laws.
Yes.
So it's important for all of our listeners to know we're talking about federal laws. Your particular state or the city in which you live might have other laws, whether they're state or local laws, that would impact decisions about folks who are sex offenders having access to schools and school property. So again, these are federal laws that we're talking about. You're going to want to check, you know, within your own jurisdiction to see what else might be applicable. But the laws we're talking about are going to apply to everyone in the country.
Right. And just to be clear, these laws apply to sex offenders who have completed their sentence. So these are people who have already been convicted, they have served their time, they have left prison, but they are still subject to laws and regulations.
So if you've ever heard someone say, well, as part of the conviction, they had to register as a sex offender.
Right.
That's the classification of the group of people that we're talking about, those people who are registered sex offenders.
And even this registration process is fairly new. So in looking back at the history of sex offenders and laws that relate to sex offenders, the first one was established in 1994. In fact, you know, one thing that kind of struck me as I was going through the history here, as I was learning more about the history of these laws, is that all of these laws resulted from some terrible tragedy that these parents faced, the kidnapping, the death of a child, and then their subsequent efforts to make sure that this never happened to anybody else. So I thought that was, you know, both mm-hmm. kind of sad, but also inspiring in a certain way. So for example, the 1994 Jacob Wetterling Act was the first one of its kind, and basically 4 months after their 11-year-old son was kidnapped and murdered, this family began an advocacy group designed to make sure that this never happens to anybody again, and it ultimately led to the first federal law requiring states to register sex offenders. But this registry information was initially for law enforcement only. In 1996, just several years later, we had Megan's Law established, and this was a 7-year-old girl, Megan, who was raped and murdered by her neighbor, who had a history, previous convictions for sexually assaulting young girls. These parents advocated for amending the previous law, the 1994 Act, to require mandatory notification to the community. Eventually, this did become a law. It required publicly disclosed information, but only when required to protect the public. So you still hear that there's caveats here. In 1996, there was an adult, Pam Lichner, she was a victim of an attempted rape, and she and her husband ended up advocating for victims' rights, which eventually resulted in a national database of offenders and the requirement that state officials immediately transmit that information to the national registry. So you also hear how there's gaps between the state and the federal level that these laws are trying to close. The most recent law was the 2006 Adam Walsh Act. Adam Walsh was a 6-year-old when he was kidnapped and murdered in Florida. His father actually became an advocate for victims of violent crimes, as well as the host of America's Most Wanted. He also founded the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And this law really enacted a systemic change. The law named for Adam reorganized sex offenders into three tiers mm-hmm. based on the severity of the offense and mandated updated whereabouts for tier two and tier three offenders. So in other words, even after tier two and tier three offenders are released from prison, they still have to update their living arrangements, their addresses with officials, and tier two offenders have to do this for 25 years, and tier three offenders have to do this forever. Interestingly, not all states have come into compliance with this law, which conditions certain funds on compliance. And of course, you know, we're talking about federal laws, as you previously said.
Right. So I think it's important to also think about or recognize that, you know, different states are perhaps at different levels of compliance, or they're maybe applying the law differently. In Ohio, for example, the Ohio Supreme Court, or the Supreme Court of Ohio, said that the Adam Walsh law could not be applied retroactively. So if you are somebody who was convicted of a crime that would be a sex offense back before the law went into effect in 2006, and before the three-tiered system went into effect, you're not going to be under that three-tiered system.
That's right.
So you're not going to have the same types of reporting requirements that are required for folks who are convicted after 2006.
Right.
So different states have at least a little bit of discretion in terms of how they've done that. And I recognize where the Supreme Court of Ohio was going with this in terms of a fundamental fairness question of, well, you know, can you really assign mm-hmm. folks who were convicted before this law ever went into effect under this system when this wasn't even the law, when they maybe committed the crime or were convicted of the crime?
Right.
So that's the reason that there's a little bit of difference both between states and then also in terms of when different things are going to come in terms of when somebody might have been convicted of their crime.
Right. And also, there's different state regulations regarding how far an offender must live from a school. Mm-hmm. Some states have no restrictions. Some states say a registered sex offender may not live within 1,000 feet of a school building, and others have higher restrictions,
right.
2,000 feet or so on. These laws, as we know, can be pretty controversial.
Absolutely. I mean, some people feel that, you know, offenders should be organized not by the severity of the offense, but by their risk of reoffending. Other people feel, you know, that if you were a juvenile when you committed your offense, you know, maybe you should
right.
be treated differently because mm-hmm. you were under the age of 18 when the offense was committed. Some people think that there's, you know, maybe a more philosophical implication here in terms of, yes, you were convicted, but you also did the time associated with that. And when you have finished doing your time, then
you're
you
done.
Should just be
yeah.
given a clean slate, right?
Yeah.
You're done.
Mm-hmm.
And these things are also really very controversial for school districts because, you know, think about, you've got a large population mm-hmm. of students in a school district and you're trying to navigate, how do I work through all of this, particularly when the sex offender is somebody who might be a parent of a child in your school district or one of your community members in your school district? What restrictions can you place on their access? And what do you do with that if you're a school trying to make sure that your
yeah.
students are safe, but you're also not violating the rights of somebody who lives in your community?
Right. So schools, I think everybody will agree, this part's not controversial. Schools are central community gathering mm-hmm. places for the whole community. And parents want to be involved. Parents genuinely want to come to their child's classroom and make cupcakes and be involved in the PTA. But what about that parent who is a registered sex offender? How do you balance that? What steps do you take to, when you're trying to decide, can we have this dad come into the classroom for their child's sixth birthday party like all the other dads are able to come in? You know, I think these are difficult decisions, but here are some of the steps that we've thought about that we see school districts taking. So first of all, I think if you're an administrator and you're faced with a situation, what you want to do is make sure you're familiar with your state and local laws. So does your state or local law have any restrictions on sex offenders, where they can be present, and if there's any violations that they would commit simply by being on school
sure.
grounds? It's unlikely, but you should still take a look at that, make sure that you're aware of any relevant state or local laws. Now, one thing that is very common is parole requirements. So after anybody, regardless of the kind of offense they've committed, is released from prison, they're very often subject to parole requirements, which are also called community control. These are restrictions that are placed on them for a certain amount of time, maybe a year, maybe 2 years. Those are designed to reintegrate them back into the community in a safe way. So many sex offenders have strict restrictions on their release for a certain time after their sentence ends. That can relate to coming into contact with minors or where children congregate. And the way that you would find this out is you would actually need to contact that individual's parole officer. And this is, it's just more of like finding the right person to call. Sometimes you have to call around and get the right number, speak to the right person, but generally once you reach the right person, they're very forthcoming with whether this particular person has any parole requirements or whether those have all expired. And then, of course, you should also be looking at your district's policies. So many districts have general policies limiting who can volunteer and in what capacity and how visitors to the schools are handled. Mm-hmm. In reviewing your policy and guidelines, you should keep in mind that it's always better to adjust these policies and guidelines before this issue comes up.
Yes.
So if you're listening to this podcast and you don't have any questions like this on the horizon, don't just tune out and change the channel. Instead, you should go back and look at your policies and say, how can we tweak these policies so that we can, for example, put in there something about how volunteers need to have clean background checks and need to not have any of these crimes in their history in order to volunteer with students. Because if your policy specifically spells that out, that's something that you can legitimately rely on in letting a parent know that, I'm sorry, we will not be able to accommodate your volunteering request. So that's something that you can, you know, discuss with your administrative team and board about making changes if those policies are not specific enough.
I think that's really important, but it's also important to understand that if you're just dealing with a situation where a parent wants to access something that everybody in the community would have access to, right? So this is different than a parent who says, I want to come in and be a volunteer in my child's classroom, and I understand that not everybody gets to do that. You know, there's a selection process that goes on. But maybe it's, I want to go to the board meeting, or I want to go to the Friday night football game, right, or things of that nature. There's probably going to be less restrictions on that type of activity because those are activities that are open to everybody in the community. You know, right. So the district might not be able to do as much with that, but keep in mind, those are also situations that are going to be, I'm going to say, maybe less open to mischief, if you will, yeah, because it's not as though you have an adult who is going to be working in a classroom, maybe one-on-one with a student or with students. These are things that really are more community-based events.
The question always is, does this parent have a legitimate purpose for coming onto school grounds? Mm-hmm. And typically, a legitimate purpose would include something related to the parent-child relationship, or something perhaps related to a First Amendment issue where everybody else has access. So, for example, if everybody in Bobby's classroom is allowed to bring cupcakes when it's their child's birthday, but Bobby's dad cannot, that might lead the district into a question of, are you now interfering with that parent-child relationship? Or if Susie's mom is the only parent not allowed to come to the board meeting about the levy, you know, and every other parent is allowed, then now you might have a First Amendment question in which you could possibly err on the side of allowing that parent to come in. But there will be other situations where there's no legitimate reason. If there's no legitimate reason, if there's no parent-child relationship or First Amendment issue at stake, if the parent just wants to, you know, volunteer at a bake sale, you can legitimately prevent that sex offender parent from doing that because there's no general right to volunteer at bake sales with other kids. There's no, you know, constitutional or statutory right.
So do you have any thoughts or advice in terms of how districts should maybe set up those limitations?
You know, I always think that it's good to set that up in advance. So you're always going to be in a more hostile and combative situation if the request has already been made and now you have to deny it and you have to explain yourself. So that's a more tense situation. Whereas if you're proactive, you know, once it comes to your attention that you have a parent in the district who is a registered sex offender, you might want to after reviewing all the local laws, policies, after conferring with counsel, you might want to draft a letter to that parent and say, you know, here are the legitimate reasons that we will allow you to be on school grounds. And, you know, those include meetings about your child, parent-teacher conferences, as well as anything else that everybody is invited to. But other than that, we're not going to permit you to be on campus, and as well as any other restrictions that you place upon the parents. So some school districts will place a restriction where the sex offender parent has to be walked from the office to their child's classroom with a principal. And this can be very inconspicuous, but that's a restriction that a school district can choose to place. But I would always advise you to let the individual know ahead of time so that there's less potential for conflict right there in the school hallway.
I agree with that. You know, something else that I've had districts do in the past for, say, an IEP meeting, right, where you're going to have parents in the building, whether, you know, if they weren't comfortable having the parents in the building at all, or they just thought that it was going to be an uncomfortable situation for other reasons, they said, you know what, we'll just have this meeting at the Board of Education office, right? There's no students there, so we think that it's an easier situation to not have this person, you know, in our elementary school or in our junior high school. We'll go ahead and move the meeting. That's not inhibiting that parent's right or access to a meeting that they need to be at.
Right.
It's just changing the parameters a little bit.
Yeah, changing the location. Yeah. Another question that we sometimes get is about informing others. So let's say I'm an administrator. Should I tell all the parents? Should I tell all the parents in Bobby's class that Bobby's dad served time for being a child molester? You know, like, is that something I should no.
I'm gonna say that's gonna be a bad idea.
No, don't do that. Generally, don't do that. I mean, and
people have access to these lists, right? It doesn't have to come from the school district. If you're one of those people who really wants to get online and access the list, you can. I mean, you can look for sex offenders in my neighborhood kind of thing, right?
Right. That's a registry. That's why it's available.
It's available.
But at the same time, you know, I understand why I, as a parent, you know, would definitely want to know if my child's friend's dad has this criminal history. But at the same time, you know, you have to balance that with Bobby's needs, right? So you don't necessarily want everybody to know this about Bobby's dad, because Bobby might not have any friends. Bobby might start being bullied. That may create a whole host of other difficulties that the district now has to deal with because that information was released. So typically, there is no legal obligation and there's no recommendation from us to let all the parents know of any particular parent's criminal history and background. Many school district policies do have a provision of letting school employees know about a specific parent's background just for student safety. And I think when you're having those conversations with your teachers, with your staff, it's important to stress that confidentiality and that sensitivity piece, because we don't want, again, to create a situation where teachers are like, oh my God, you know, did you hear about Bobby's dad? I just heard, you know, and then that, again, it might lead to situations where Bobby is feeling excluded, isolated, bullied, harassed, and it just creates a whole host of other confidentiality issues for the district.
The big takeaway here is that these are really tough, challenging situations, and you know, they need to be handled with sensitivity, but you also need to make sure that you're handling them in a uniform manner, right? So we can't treat Bobby's dad differently than Johnny's dad, different from Claire's dad, right? So we've got to make sure that we're handling everything the same way. I think this is a really good time if you're an administrator listening to this, and like Miriam said, if you don't have something that's come up right now, go back, take a look at your policies and see, do we have a policy that we think would cover this? If we don't have a policy, do we want to think about putting one in place? And if you do find yourself involved in a situation like this, this is one where we would say to you, you probably want to contact legal counsel, because you don't want to infringe on the rights of the individual who is the sex offender, but you also want to make sure that you're doing everything that you can to ensure the safety of your students.
Exactly. So if you are facing the situation, call your school attorney right now. All right. Thanks for joining us in talking about this difficult topic. Next time, we're going to talk about manifestation determination reviews and common mistakes that we see school districts making in these decisions. So please join us for that. And also, in the meantime, rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a big, fat 5-star rating. And have
a
great day.
And send us fan mail.
Oh, yeah, fan mail. We love fan mail. Thank you.
Have a great day.
Bye.
The content of this podcast is provided for general information purposes only. The podcast is not legal advice, does not create an attorney-client relationship, and should not be relied upon in making legal decisions. Actions on legal matters should be taken only upon advice of legal counsel. Walter Haverfield does not guarantee the accuracy of information contained in this podcast.